This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7, The Fan.
Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable. I'm your host, Post-Gazette Sports Editor Jerry Micco, and I'm joined in studio today by the PG's Gene Collier and 93.7, The Fan Panther Reaction co-host and PantherLair.com publisher Chris Peek, a newcomer to the show. Chris, welcome to the show. First timer here on the Roundtable. On this week's show, we're going to take a look at Pitt and the NCAA tournament as it enters round three. I'm still trying to get the round straight, guys. I always thought you had to play a round before you could be in the second round. But anyway, it is round three, and how the Penguins are positioned for the stretch run and what the labor landscape looks like in the NFL. And, Chris, I'm going to start with you. New guys get to go first.
All right.
Pitt won its first round game. Kind of a slow start. I mean, get your reaction to that. A little bit of a slow start. They have Butler today, later today. In Washington. Butler, of course, had that Cinderella run last year. Don't look like the same team this year, though, but can Pitt afford another slow start against these guys like they did against UNC Asheville?
I mean, at some point it's going to catch up. This is a bit of a disturbing trend for the Panthers. I mean, coming down the stretch the last 10 or 11 games, they averaged something like less than 30 points per first half. The Connecticut game in the Big East tournament being the exception, which, of course, they lost because they didn't rebound well. I thought that Pitt would get out of that trend when they got into the postseason, but they did it again on Thursday against Asheville. The second half, they played like a number one seed should against a 16 seed, but you know, once you start getting into these higher-seeded teams, these eight seeds or a four seed, you're not going to be able to start slow. You're going to have to play 40 minutes of good, consistent basketball. I'd say the upside of Thursday's game is that they rebounded very well, which I think had been questionable coming down the stretch. So that's obviously something they'll need to continue, given the way Butler rebounded against Old Dominion. But they need to start strong. They need to start off well. They can't have slow starts as you get further in this tournament.
Gene, you think that's more of a product yesterday of rust? The Pitt had a little bit of rust, or is this they were 3-3 in their last six games, including the Big East tournament, and you saw this kind of trend happening. And Chris is right to point out that once they got going, they were fine. They looked like a number one seed. But, you know, that gets more difficult as the tournament goes on. I just think the Butler game just poses some problems for them. Not that I think they'll lose it. I think they'll win, but it'll be a lot tougher sled than it was certainly against UNC Asheville.
I was going to ask Chris, is there any data on these slow starts that Pitt has had in the last six games? Does it have anything to do with the starting time? Because basketball starting times – they're noon, they're nine. You never know. I mean, is there anything?
I haven't found any correlation. I mean, really, you're looking at like 10 games.
Really?
Anywhere from noon to
9
p.m.
I don't know what to say about that, Jerry. I mean, anything can beat you at this point. I mean, look at the way, the Penn State-Temple game went yesterday. I mean, I think Temple went 15 for 17 from the line. That'll usually win you the game. So you never know. Butler, I like Butler a lot. I just don't think they're good enough to beat Pitt. I think Pitt is just deeper than them and probably a better defensive team and a better rebounding team. Last year, of course, it would have been different, but, Butler's best players in the NBA. And, I think Pitt will win this game easier than a lot of people think they will. I think it'll be a 10-12 point game.
Yeah, I think, that they have that capability to certainly do that. And one of the reasons why I think, and Chris, in your role as publisher of PantherLair.com, you see these guys all the time. So you watch the play of these individual players, and it seems more and more guard play postseason very important, and Pitt has one of the best than Ashton Gibbs. I mean, Gibbs yesterday too, another big game, scoring game, seemed to be more the go-to guy. And I always think of Brad Wanamaker in that role for Pitt. But yes, they seem like it was Ashton Gibbs.
Yeah, and you're looking at two consecutive games now, 27 and 26 points with the Connecticut game. He's hitting strong. I think he's, 12 out of 16 in the last two games from three. That's what you want him to be. You want a guy to step up like that in the tournament. And the interesting thing about Brad Wanamaker is he's really a guy who sort of sets everything up. He leads the team in assists. He's the guy who sort of makes it go. And if it falls on him to score, I believe he can. Obviously, he didn't do a whole lot of that on Thursday. But he really sets things up. So many looks that Gibbs gets come from things that Wanamaker does. But I think you're absolutely right. You don't want to say one player, especially in a team like Pitt, can make all the difference. But if Ashton Gibbs keeps shooting like this, you have to like Pitt's chances going deep into this thing.
And I think, and Gene, I'll pose a similar question to you. And Gibbs, it seems like in the last two games, right, 27, 26 points. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy who, you know, I mean, you've got to have that kind of guy, I mean, for the tournament. You have to have that one guy you can look to and say, he's our guy, he's our scorer. I mean, Connecticut does it with Kemba Walker, and Walker can maybe do more things. He's a really gifted player. But you look at Ashton Gibbs yesterday, I thought, wow, here's a guy who, you know, boy, if he plays like this, and this is a trend we're seeing, mm-hmm. two, three games in a row like this,
right.
I think Pitt can make that run behind a guy like that who, if he keeps shooting that way.
It would figure. You know, it's interesting, though. A month and a half ago, we were all saying that Pitt has no one like that they can go to and really
right.
rely on for a big basket. And now it looks like it's Ashton Gibbs. It'll be interesting to see how Jamie plays given that emergence. You know, Pitt likes to play where everybody scores between 10 and 13 points. And now you got a guy scoring 27. I don't know if it'll be disruptive. It looks like a strength, certainly. Mm-hmm. But it'll be interesting to see how it will play out. I think the one thing that Pitt cannot afford under any circumstances for anybody else to wipe out Dick Groat at the scorer's table.
Oh, boy.
Because the man is 80. I mean, if that had happened to me, I'd be in the hospital today, and I'd stay there for a while.
And wasn't it Nasir Robinson? Mm-hmm. So it's a guy that's not a small guy either.
No, a large
man. He's a guy who
crashing into 80-year-old Dick Groat.
Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, oh, my God, it's Dick Groat.
In fact, if I were Jamie, I'd say that in a huddle. I don't care what you do, but
don't
wipe
Dick
out Groat. Dick Groat again.
Dick Groat was a tremendous athlete in his day. He still must have a little bit left. He's got up.
Some muscle tone. He was right up. Found his glasses. See, I wouldn't be able to find my glasses.
If he'd hit Billy Hillgrove, I don't know.
Left there on a cart.
Billy's a tough guy, too. But anyway, even the announcers for Pitt play physical. it's like it's a reputation. Looking at the tournament, let's look at Pitt's bracket. They're in the Southeast. You know, Chris, you know, difficulty of that region. I mean, Florida looked really good Thursday night in winning their game against UC Santa Barbara. What's the difficulty of that bracket? Where do you see the Pitt? Is it just Florida in that bracket? I didn't think it was a real strong bracket myself, but maybe I'm overlooking a couple things.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're going to rank the brackets in terms of favorability, Pitt's would probably be number one. Mm-hmm. But I think we saw some things yesterday. Kansas State played a pretty sloppy game and still got out against Utah State on Thursday. Kansas State's a tough team. You can't overlook Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I think Gonzaga, I'm not too impressed with, but BYU, if you have a player like Jimmer Fredette, even though they're missing the things they're missing, they're always dangerous. It's always going to be something you have to keep an eye on. And UCLA has had success in the tournament. You never say a region is easy, but I do think Pitt's got the most favorable out mm-hmm. of the four regions. But it's kind of contradicted by what I just said about how many tough teams
right.
there are. I do think they might have maybe the smoothest path to the Final Four. I mean, I think Kansas has a bit of a favorable road. But, you know, Pitt's, I look at it, and I can't see any strong, convincing evidence that mm-hmm. they shouldn't make a Final Four out of this region.
Gene, looking at the, you know, going through the bracket and when mm-hmm. you look at Pitt, a lot of people thought Pitt had an easy road to the Final Four. But I think it's like Chris, and I did too. I was one of the ones that thought that Pitt might have had the easiest path, maybe Duke. But I think, you know, Pitt now may have it. Nonetheless, when I look down the road at teams they may play, like a Wisconsin or something like that, you know, now this is a team that scored 33 points against Penn State, so we'll say that, you know, but Wisconsin's sure. a big, strong team like Pitt. I always wonder how Pitt fares against teams that are like them almost, where their whole thing is defense and rebounding. I mean, I don't know how they usually fare against those kinds of teams. I mean, like a Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's more like a Big East team, I think.
Yeah.
And I was surprised when I was watching the selection show on Sunday. I was surprised first to see Charles Barkley there. I was thinking, what is Charles Barkley doing there? And the first thing he said was he thought Pitt has had an easy path. And I thought, well, he knows nothing about nothing. Now, somebody else is going to say the opposite, which they did immediately.
Of course.
But now, you know, the more we've been talking about it for 6 days. It looks to me like they do have an easy path. I mean, I know they're the number one. There's certainly nobody in the bracket they can't beat.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, that's why they're the number one. But, I mean, the teams that have a shot against them, I really don't buy. I really don't buy BYU. I know they have a great record. They mm-hmm. have a great RPI. You know, and Jimmer Fredette is wonderful. But, I mean, I don't think they can beat Pitt. And I think Florida is way overseeded. I was stunned to see them get a two. And Kansas State, as Chris pointed out, you know, looked really ragged the other day. At the beginning of this, I was cautioning people that, you can't have too high a standard for Pitt because, you know, there's a preposterous standard mm-hmm. in Pittsburgh for everybody, the Penguins, the Steelers, not the Pirates, obviously. That's right. But on the other hand, I mean, I fully expect them to come out of the bracket. And on the other hand, I think we're sitting here a year to the day from the occasion of Ohio U beating Georgetown. If mm-hmm. Ohio U can beat Georgetown, you know, anybody can lose to anybody once this stuff starts, especially if it gets it into a second or third round, whatever this is.
Yeah, I guess it'll be the third round coming up on today. It is the third round. You guys had a chance, and Chris, you got a chance to watch, or hopefully you had a chance to watch, West Virginia-Clemson. A game that I really thought Clemson would get in a lot of trouble, and they did for the time being, and then West Virginia went on like a 21-3 to run over the end of the first half, beginning of the second. You know, what's its road look like? And they're in the East region. They're in the region with Ohio State, you know, and they have Kentucky today. So what's, you know, any chance to beat Kentucky? I mean, they did last year in the Elite Eight. What about today in the final, in the region? Third round, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's a chance. I think there's always a chance. As Gene pointed out, Ohio U and Georgetown, there's always a chance. But West Virginia's just got flaws. I mean, they're missing key pieces. Their mm-hmm. guard play was a problem last year, and I think it's a problem this year. Truck Bryant's not going to score 19 every game like he did against Clemson. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the road for West Virginia or Kentucky, in my opinion, is short, because at the end of that road is Ohio State in the fourth round or whichever round it would be. And so, almost regardless of who wins the West Virginia-Kentucky game, I don't see either one beating the Buckeyes.
So it's a short run, even if they beat Kentucky.
I think so.
I think you're probably right about that.
The only thing that interests me about West Virginia, Jerry, is how long Bob Huggins is going to continue to insist on wearing that sweatsuit zip to the neck indoors. I mean, I applaud him for being willing to look unlike anybody else on the sideline. I'm for that because I don't really know why basketball players wear suits anyway. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever.
It's like he's in a retirement.
No, they should have to, like baseball man, they should have to dress like the players.
Well, there you go. Ooh, I don't know if you'd want that.
Now, Gene, is your contention with the sweats, the tracksuit, or the fact that he zips it all the way up to his neck?
Well, I think the suit. I think it's a good statement. You know, that everyone else is ridiculous, but he's equally ridiculous in having it zipped to his neck. I mean, he thinks he looks slimmer in it, and Bob, it's not working for you, really.
Well, speaking of equally ridiculous, we're going to move this show on. Up next, we're going to talk about the Penguins. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back. I'm Jerry Micko. I'm with the PG's Gene Collier and 93.7 The Fan Panther Reaction co-host Chris Peek. Guys, time to talk a little bit of Penguins. And this week, news outlets reporting that Sidney Crosby, the Penguins are going to ring for the stretch run. And here in the regular season, and part of that is that Sidney Crosby has been doing some light skating, a little bit of light work on the ice, and that really is big news, because for a while you just didn't hear much from Sidney Crosby, and now he's been on the ice, I think, two or three times. You know, he's skating again, so, Gene, I'll start with you on this. You know, what chances the Penguins have, you know, are they playing this close to the vest? They want to see Crosby back this year. Do you think they're just going to kind of keep playing this by ear? Do you think they know a little more and they think, you know, we can probably get this guy back for the playoffs? Or is this something that they, you know, maybe say, look, let him go out and skate, but we really have no desire to bring him back and maybe get another concussion?
Well, Jerry, I always think that the Penguins and really any hockey team is always, or rather always knows more than letting on about somebody's injury. I'm surprised, really, even to this point, that they've acknowledged that Sidney has anything more than an upper body injury. I'm glad, you know, I know they're glad to see him skate. I mean, neither outcome would surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me if we didn't see him in the games until next fall. And depending on how it goes for him, I suppose he could be back in some kind of playoff situation. But here you are, you're 3.5 weeks from a playoff game, and he hasn't really probably literally broken a sweat out there yet. So that's, to me, that says he's not going to be ready this year, but, you know, that's just me.
Yeah. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know about the strategy angle, because you're looking at, you know, say they want to surprise everyone and bring him back for the playoffs. You're still looking at, you know, 7-game series. If it was a 1-game situation, maybe mm-hmm. you could surprise someone by bringing him back. I think they play it close to the vest because it's in the DNA and chromosomes of NHL management and upper management to play everything close to the mm-hmm. best. But I don't know if there's much strategy involved, because I don't think you really get the jump on another team when you're playing a seven-game series. Mm-hmm. It kind of takes away that strategy element of being secretive about when he'll come back.
And we're going to talk to bring someone in now who's around this every day, Post-Gazette Penguins beat reporter Dave Molinari. Dave, thanks for taking the time to join us here on the roundtable.
Oh, it's my pleasure, guys.
Dave, well, I'll ask you the same question, or at least get your thoughts on this. I mean, you've been reporting about Sidney Crosby taking the ice, doing some light skating, and you're around the Penguins all the time. What's their they play a lot of things close to the vest, but this one seems to be very close to the vest, kind of managed even when Sid's going to come out and skate and when he's going to talk to you guys. And what's your take on all this?
Oh, yeah, they certainly are managing this very heavily. But I really believe that they don't know yet whether he will be medically able to play again at some point this spring. Certainly him going on the ice several times during the past week is a big step in his recovery, but as you guys mentioned, it's not like he has been exerting himself out there. He's nowhere near being in game shape, and there's always the possibility of a setback. He never knows when he goes on the ice if that's going to be the session that leads to a recurrence of his concussion symptoms. And, when that happens, he's pretty much back to square one. So, I don't think that they have decided that he won't play again this season, but I certainly think they're prepared for that possibility.
Dave, what is your guess on this hypothetical? Say Jordan Staal is injured and, it's a lower body injury that keeps him from skating at all. And he misses, as Sidney has now, almost 3 months. How long does it take to get into hockey shape?
Oh, probably a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. I guess you could accelerate the process, if you're in the playoffs or something like that, yeah. or maybe send the guy back a bit earlier than you might care to. Obviously, though, with a head injury, with any player, but particularly one who's as big of an asset to his franchise as Crosby is, they're certainly going to err on the side of caution, right, with him, even if they would have to write off one mm-hmm. playoff spring. That's just a very tiny part of the big picture of his career.
We're speaking with the Post-Gazette's Penguins beat writer, Dave Molinari, here on the roundtable. Dave, when you talk about head injuries now, the NHL's all over it. The general managers didn't make any recommendations of the Board of Governors, but Gary Bettman has a five-point plan to address player and head safety in the NHL. Do you think that's going to make a difference, or is this just a sport where, head hits and head, well, they've taken some of that out, but head injuries are just going to be a part of it?
Well, head injuries, blows to the head, you're never going to get them out of the game entirely. You can't legislate them out of the game, any more than the NFL has been able to. Mm-hmm. But you certainly can make players aware that there will be a punishment when they deliver a blow to the head. And I really would have liked to have seen the NHL general managers make a recommendation like that to the Board of Governors, that any blow to the head, inadvertent or otherwise, would produce at least a two-minute minor penalty, and then, you take it from there going all the way up to a lifetime ban, I suppose, mm-hmm. if somebody did something sufficiently heinous. But as I say, there are always going to be blows to the head. Guys who hit an opponent with a forearm in the chest, their arm will slide up and hit the guy in the chin occasionally, that sort of thing. But I think that if players are made aware that any time they hit an opponent in the head, that it's going to lead to some sort of sanction, I certainly think it'll reduce the number of headshots in the game.
Well, Dave, I'm of the opinion, along with what you were saying there, I'm a very big zero-tolerance guy on head shots and contact with the head in the NHL and the NFL. I don't know if it'll ever get to that point, but how close, realistically, do you think the NHL could get to having kind of what you were saying there? I mean, just absolute zero tolerance, intent intent notwithstanding, if you make contact with the head, there's penalty.
Oh, there is certainly some sentiment. The Penguins are big backers of that idea. There's definitely some sentiment among upper management and ownership levels for that kind of a blanket ban, but there obviously wasn't enough support for that idea for the governors to take something like that to the Board of Governors, which almost certainly would rubber stamp whatever the GMs suggest they do. So while the GMs could only have made a recommendation, whatever they suggested almost certainly would have been put into effect for next season.
Dave, are you familiar enough with the five-point plan? You know, whenever I see someone come out of a meeting with a five-point plan, I'm always suspicious because I always think, you know, at some point this was a four-point plan, and somebody else said, you know what, you're going to need another point, and then you'll have a five-point plan, and therefore it'll have to be taken seriously. Well, guess what? Not really. But I'm wondering if part of what's holding this up is if you outlaw all hits to the head, you know, I mean, I wouldn't put it past the NHL to become the first, governing body to ban all hits to the head except for with the knuckles. Does this mean, I mean, do you think they're stumbling on that very thing? I mean, it sounds facetious, but if you disallow all hits to the head, does that end fighting?
I don't think so, Gina. My take on it is that the league sees those as completely separate issues.
I see. Well, that figures.
And that right now, while there is a large and staunch anti-fighting faction, both among teams and the game's fan base, I don't see any move that's likely to get that outlawed anytime in the near future. Mm-hmm. And as I say, the league will view those as completely separate.
Yeah, it's entities.
You can hit a guy in the chin with your fist, but don't do it with your elbow.
It's a hard
or your
thing
shoulder.
To get. Dave, I was watching the Rangers Flyers game, I think it was last weekend, and the Rangers were killing. It was 4-0 or 5-0. And Jeff Richards started a fight with one of the Rangers, and the color guy, who I forget who was doing color on the, it was a national broadcast, but he said, "Now see, that's leadership." And I was thinking, "Oh, it's funny. It looks like assault to me." but that's exactly what you're saying. There's a faction there, and a really well-rooted faction that is not going to give up on that.
Yeah, and I mean, if you want to see an example of that in Pittsburgh, just go back to the playoffs 2 years ago.
Sure.
When the Penguins were getting thumped in Philadelphia in, I believe it was game 6 of that series, mm-hmm. down 3 goals, and Max Talbot went out and made himself a human sacrifice to Daniel Carcillo.
Dave, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember talking to you in the press box that day before we went downstairs, and I said, I think this is a shaky premise, but I'm going to pretend that this is what turned the game around, or I'm going to see if I can get anybody to bite on the notion that this turned the game around. And they were not only were they willing to bite on it, I mean that's all anybody wanted to talk about.
Oh yeah, the idea that anything else had played an impact or had an impact on the outcome of that game was pretty much summarily dismissed.
Right.
Everybody involved pointed to the Talbot fight as the turning point.
Even though the Penguins had scored, I think, 5 unanswered goals.
Yes, which
which had nothing to do with it, of course.
Made a habit of in Philadelphia.
Right.
So,
Dave, we've got about 30 seconds or so left. Real quick, some of the upcoming opponents: Rangers, Flyers, Devils. Make or break kind of week for the Penguins to make a move here.
Well, certainly they still have a couple of games left with the Flyers before the end of the month, and those stand out as the big ones on their schedule. But they're only big if they do well against the Rangers on Saturday, mm-hmm. On Sunday, and then get a point or possibly two out of Detroit when they go there on Monday. They still have a mathematical shot, obviously, at catching the Flyers, but they're going to have to play some awfully good hockey and probably have the Flyers do a little slipping just to make it all come together for them.
Well, Dave, thanks for taking the time to join us today. Appreciate the insight.
Oh, my pleasure, guys.
It's Dave Molinari, the Post-Gazette beat writer for the Penguins. Here on the Roundtable, this is the Post-Gazette Roundtable. Next up, we talk NFL labor on 93.7 The Fan.
Back to the Post-Gazette Roundtable on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Jerry Micco, and joining me are the PG's Gene Collier and 93.7 The Fan Panther Reaction co-host Chris Peek. Gene, the NFL labor situation is headed for two areas, the courtroom and the court of public opinion. And one way to get attention is to say something like Minnesota running back Adrian Peterson said earlier this week, equating the players' labor issues to slavery. And then he had the Steelers' Rashard Mendenhall jump on board with a series of tweets that he did. This is just a byproduct of what happens when these guys, you know, when the mediations broke off and each one goes to their corner, they just like fire shots at each other. This is it. This is what.
No, this is a byproduct of being an idiot, Jerry.
This is which one, Adrian Peterson? I'm
fascinated by it. I'm sure you know, players used to love to say that they're kind of hostage to the media in terms of getting their message out to the fan, because you know we sometimes misquote them or we quote them out of context or don't provide the right context. And now, of course, when you can tweet, you can go right to the fans. You can bypass that little media labyrinth, and this is what you get: comments like this, indicating that the players are slavery. And you know, there's no minimizing, what the player's situation is. There are many areas in which I think they should be treated better when it comes to healthcare and preventative stuff. I mean, that's all true, but really, the next time you watch the NFL draft. Ask yourself if anyone has fled to Canada to avoid the NFL draft. I don't think that really happens. Apparently Adrian and Rashard share this. They were not history majors because, whatever definition of slavery this is, I never came across it.
Well, yeah, it's that funny slavery where you get paid or something. To your point, Gene, it's a situation where athletes and really anyone can kind of control their own message, which – by definition, you might think that's a good thing, but it's not a good thing. These guys obviously need a buffer of some sorts.
They need some context.
They need someone to provide that context for them. And they end up saying things like this. I mean, you got to be smarter than that. You got to realize that's not going to lead anywhere good. You know, the end result of saying it's like slavery, it's not going to work out for you.
Well, let me bring in someone who's covered this league for a long time and has covered strikes and lockouts and all the things that come with it. Post-Gazette Steelers beat writer Ed Bouchette. Hi, Ed. Thanks for taking the time to join us here on the Roundtable.
Thanks, Gene. Hello, Chris. I mean, thanks, Jerry. Hello, Gene and Chris. And let me just say this. Athletes were saying a lot of dumb things before Twitter came along and were duly recorded by willing reporters.
That's true.
Yeah, I guess that's never really stopped, has it? Ed, where do you – I mean – it seems like both sides have kind of gone to their neutral corners and they're firing their shots. I mean, Greg Aiello is tweeting unrelentingly talking points. You've got players popping off. How long is this going to go on for? Ed, is this just part of what they do and how these things go?
Well, Jerry, it might get so bad that we come to a point where they start firing jelly donuts at one another as they did during the 87 strike. It really got out of hand there. They're just going to keep it up. They're trying to capture the hearts and minds of the public. And I think the public doesn't want to be captured right now. They just want to see that football is going to be played, but we still have another, 6 months, 5.5 months until that starts occurring. So, I really don't think there's an urgency, and maybe that's part of the problem right now.
And that might be it. I guess there's no more dead time anymore in the NFL, but this would kind of qualify as close to it as you get, wouldn't it, Ed? If it was a regular season and not a lockout, these guys would just be doing some workouts and things like that, right?
Yeah, the Steelers would be doing very little because they were in the Super Bowl, and the last time that happened, Mike Tomlin scaled back the dates in which they were working out. But the thing is, Jerry, we have to wait now until this winds through the courts, and I don't understand why they could not have kept talking. I don't know why. Both sides will tell you why, but I don't understand it, why they could not have kept talking. This now is just sitting there, and it's waiting for some judge to make the next ruling, which apparently isn't going to come until April 6th.
Mm-hmm.
Ed, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you. Did the offer that the owners made at the end of last week, at least the offer that they said they made, did that look to you a little closer to the outlines, at least, of something the players could accept than you thought it might?
Well, now what they were saying on Friday, Gene, is that the owners wanted a fixed salary cap, and not, in other words, they didn't want a percentage, and that's what they presented to the players on that last Friday. It's just coming out yesterday, and that.
I mean, instead of saying you get 60% of the profits,
instead of 60%, here's $140 million, and then next year, if our revenues go up in our television deal that's due in 2013, if we negotiate a much better one. Sorry, guys, your revenue is still the same.
Stay the same. Mm-hmm.
And the players couldn't accept that. But, you know, so, and the thing is, they had us decertify before the owners locked them out in order to keep the judge they think is favorable
right,
to them
right.
on the case, mm-hmm. the Doty judge in Minnesota. And it's just crazy. It was like a chess game they were playing. Instead of negotiating.
Ed, do you have a feeling, though, you know, I look at this, the players decertify, and what, an hour or two later, the lawsuit is filed. I mean, all that stuff's ready to go. The owners have been making preparations for this lockout for the past 2 or 3 years. Do you almost get a feeling, you call it a chess game, like, do you just get the feeling that the owners and players, this is going according to plan? This is how they expected everything to play out, and we're all sitting here saying, oh, no, they decertified, or oh, no, they got locked out, but this is what the plan was all along?
Good point, Chris. I mean, that's what both sides are accusing the other of doing. The owner said the union wanted to decertify all along, and the union saying the owners wanted to lock out all along, and that neither side came to the table with legitimate reasons to work this stuff out. And, you know, I tend to believe both, that neither side did intend to work it out through collective bargaining. This screams for Gene Upshaw to come back from the grave and Dan Rooney to come back from Ireland.
Yeah. And all that said, is it possible, do you think, that, you know, Judge Doty will look at this and take under advisement some recommendation from the National Labor Relations Board that, you know, they, when they were talking, they were making progress, and therefore there's no real legal need for decertification and all the litigation that follows it?
Judge Doty could rule all different kinds of ways, and right now he doesn't have the case. Another judge on his, I guess it's a panel,
I see,
has it, but it's going to eventually wind up. I think Judge Doty's the one that's going to make the decision. He's the one who made the decision, 24 years ago? Anyway, no, it wasn't quite that long ago. That's when the strike was. It was 93. Anyway, the judge that Doty also can say, first of all, Gene, the filing with the NLRB was unfair labor practice over the decertification.
Okay.
Now,
mm-hmm.
the union, the best thing that Doty can do is get an injunction against the lockout as far as fans and everybody else is concerned, because then football will go on, and they were almost it'll still wind through the courts. The owners will have lost, lost some points, but nevertheless, who cares about that? If you're a fan, you want to see Doty or that Minnesota District, Federal District Court come down with a ruling that says the lockout is we're going to set the lockout aside, the injunction against the lockout, which means they can continue to play football.
And do you see any scenario, and we've got a minute, do you see any scenario where there would be games lost? Do you think this thing's going to get done? It just might get done a little late?
Again, Jerry, it's going to depend on the courts. If the court does not come up with an injunction against the lockout continues, and they're still fighting in the courts. Now, ultimately, they can still come back together and start talking, but this looks like a thing that's going to be won or lost in courts rather than in collective bargaining talks.
So you don't see them sitting down in front of a mediator again?
The mediator people forget, the mediator, George Cohen, is the one who said they weren't anywhere near agreeing on the major issues. Mm-hmm. And there was little progress made. People think there was progress made. There wasn't. So I don't know if any more mediation is going to help. Yeah, you'd like to see it continue, but the longer this goes, the more the sides get entrenched. It's like, and I hate comparing it to a war, but it's like when you go into a war, you don't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. And you find out things get worse and worse. When you thought one thing was going to go your way, all of a sudden you're entrenched. And this thing just goes on and on and on and on. And that seems to, that could happen with this thing. You know, they broke off talks, and who knows if games could be lost. I think now more than ever, I think games could be lost. Mm. Again, it's going to depend on the judge.
Well, Ed, I know later today you're heading down to the owners' meetings in New Orleans, and I wish you a good trip. And thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate the knowledge and the insight.
Okay, Jerry. Thank you.
It's Ed Bouchette, Post-Gazette Steelers beat writer. Up next, we read fan mail. This is the Post-Gazette Roundtable here on 93.7 The Fan. Welcome back to the Roundtable, where it's time for our fan mail segment. If you'd like to have your email read on our show, please email me at jmicco@postgazette.com. That's post-gazette.com, and we'll consider it for a future show. And this week's letter is from Larry, who writes, "I found the Pirates owner Bob Nutting's comments to the team at the beginning of the spring training to be quite comical. He indicated he was not going to be content with just a 500 season, but is expecting a championship in the near future. Is he serious? After the Pirates lost 105 games last season, little money was spent to improve the team in the offseason. So where's Nutting's commitment to make the Pirates a championship-caliber team?" Well, Larry, I think that's a good point, and I think it's a point that a lot of fans of the Pirates will often discuss. You know, where's ownership's commitment on this team? Where's the money to get better players? Frank Coonley, shortly after those comments by Bob Nutting, said, well, if we can get more fans in the stands, it generates more money. But he also said that, you know, they had to do something to produce that. So the Pirates are probably doing it the only way the Pirates can do it. You've got to grow a team, and you're going to have to grow it from the minor leagues because contract reasons, you have these guys under contract for 6 years pretty much. You can do what you want with them. At that point, they become free agents, and then either you're going to lose them or you're going to sign them to bigger deals, or you can sign them to deals that are smaller and you can extend them. Look, if the Pirates spent $80 million this year, first of all, none of the top-tier free agents will come here and play because they know they're probably not going to win a championship like they would, say, in New York or Los Angeles or someplace like that where, you know, Philadelphia, Texas, San Francisco. These are all these are all franchises that spend quite a bit of money, but they already have good players on the team. So all they're doing is just adding to what they've already got. With the Pirates, they have to grow. They have to grow internally, and only then, if they get better with their internal candidates, McCutchen, Walker, Alvarez, and the pitching, if Ohlendorf and Mahalem and that group, Charlie Morton, if they start to come around, James McDonald, if that group starts to come around, then the team will get better because these guys will be better and they'll be the core group. Then you might be able to add a part, but it does no good for them to add, you know, the types of guys where you're spending $7, $8 million a year on a guy who's really kind of washed up and not worth that kind of money. You can spend $5 million or $4 million on a Lyle Overbay because Overbay had 30 home runs last year. Maybe he gets you 20, 25 this year, and that's an upgrade from what they had. So I think before people jump all over the Pirates and say, hey, they need to spend more money, you have to look at how they're spending it. They're spending it on what they think they have, what they think will work, and then down the road will give them a chance maybe to be contenders in the National League Central Division. That does it for today's Post-Gazette Roundtable. I'd like to thank today's panel, 93.7 The Fan, Panther Reaction co-host, and PantherLair.com publisher Chris Peek, and the PG's Gene Collier, and to our guests, Ed Bouchette and Dave Molinari of the Post-Gazette. Also, thanks to our producer, Matt Popchak, who puts this show together every week. I hope you'll join us on the Roundtable next Saturday on Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan. I'm Post-Gazette Sports Editor Jerry Micco. Have a great week, everyone.